Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded April 22nd, 2026. Well, nearly 4 months since the lethal attack against it, Venezuela is signing deals with Western financial operators, the World Bank, and International Monetary Fund. Acting President Delcy Rodriguez says the renewed relationship marks a great achievement of Venezuelan diplomacy and is an important step signaling good has triumphed in the besieged country. Ricardo Vosch is a journalist, political analyst, and contributor with the Communications Collective's Tatui TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and his latest there is Venezuelan Government Resumes IMF World Bank Ties, Appoints New Central Bank President. Ricardo Vosch in the first half. And Cuban authorities agree meetings were held April 10th with a U.S. delegation in Havana. Accounts of what transpired in those meetings differ between the two parties, but it seems there will be further discussions. The news comes as the nation continues to suffer the privations of a U.S. oil embargo laid atop the decades-long sanctions campaign waged by the Americans to reverse Cuba's popular revolution. Randy Caravaggio is a longtime organizer with the Victoria Friends of Cuba, a group working to aid the embattled Caribbean island nation with medical and other necessary supplies. It's a mission never more vital than now. Randy Caravaggio maintaining the people-to-people pipeline to Cuba in the second half. But first, Ricardo Vosch and Venezuela after the invasion. Welcome back to the show, Ricardo.
Hey, Chris. It's great to be back.
Well, now, Ricardo, the fourth En Defensa de la Democracia meetings were held last week in Barcelona in conjunction with the Global Progressive Movement gathering there. Ricardo, does Acting President Delcy Rodriguez's absence from those meetings signal more than just her too busy to come calendar suggests?
That's a good question. There are many ways to go about this. I'll probably start by perhaps tempering expectations a little bit about these progressive gatherings, because we've seen a lot of them over the years, and somehow they don't seem to move past this early stage of, you know, setting a common position, and, you know, really it's worth it, you know, at least setting out what's wrong in the world around us. But, you know, the next step, organizing and doing something about it, has been an issue. And many of these progressive governments have inevitably clashed with the Trump administration, but somehow they've always been threatened to take a step back. You know, recently we saw Spain refuse to allow the U.S. to use its bases, and then there's some kind of compromise reached. In the case of Venezuela, I think there are two things that might have happened, and possibly a combination of both. One is that the organizers themselves did not want Venezuela present because it's a very polarizing issue on the international sphere. So you would have had, on the one hand, governments wishing to, you know, condemn the U.S. attacks on January 3rd and, let's say, semi-colonial control since then, and on the others you would have had governments fixated on this idea that there need to be elections in Venezuela, so it might have taken the agenda elsewhere. And on the other hand, the Venezuelan government right now seems to prioritize its good relations with the United States, and so it might not have been in its interest to attend a conference where, even if it's not going to be very confrontational, it's clear that it's this current stage of U.S. imperialism that's responsible for all the upheaval we're seeing around the world. So it might have been a combination of both, maybe even a silent agreement that it was best for everyone involved, for Venezuela not to participate.
To that point, too, that Cuba didn't have high-level delegates either. I don't know if they had any. Did Venezuela send anybody to this? I mean,
I checked, and it didn't. It's actually a good point, because in the past there were conferences where maybe it was thorny and Venezuela wanted to avoid any kind of PR or diplomatic circus. And usually they would send the foreign minister in some cases, and in others, an even lower level representative. But so for this case, perhaps it's symptomatic that not even a lower level delegation was present.
Well, and there was no Cuban representation either, as far as I can tell. There might have been lower level ones, but certainly not at the top level. Which is surprising to me because it was, at least in their own literature, the conference put Cuba and Venezuela in the situation of the embargoes there front and center. So I don't know if this is just virtue signaling on their part. There didn't seem to be much other than a couple of paragraphs at the inaugural press release.
Yeah, I think it's also a case, and this might be a bit paradoxical, that it's more comfortable to defend Venezuela and Cuba without them being there, because if they are there, then they might generate all these discussions about quote-unquote democracy and human rights and so on. And so if they're not, you can have these kinds of minimal statements and positions condemning U.S. attacks without, you know, it escalating from there.
Well, Al Jazeera reported that Mexico, Brazil, and Spain pledged more aid to Cuba. I don't see Venezuela mentioned there. Have those countries done the same? Have they pledged help, aid, or anything to weaken the stranglehold on Venezuela? Or is it just assumed that Venezuela is a done deal and that they are going to be doing deals and they don't need the help of Mexico or the Brazil or Spain?
I think in the case of Venezuela, it never got to a stage where the humanitarian situation was so dire as to need this immediate deliveries of humanitarian aid. There's still some criticism necessary because what Cuba needs, I mean, of course it needs everything, but what it needs more than shipments of rice and medicines is fuel. And so these countries have found a cop-out in saying, you know, we're not going to send crude in order not to upset Trump. And instead, we're going to send humanitarian supplies, which, I mean, of course, they help in the short term, but they do not solve the structural issues. In the case of Venezuela, there was never such a dire, or maybe it was a few years ago, but right now there wasn't such a dire humanitarian situation to need those kinds of emergency supplies. And since Venezuela is an oil producer, and according to official reports, I'm not sure I buy them completely, it's now self-sufficient in terms of fuel production. It never gets to a point where the society is kind of on the verge of collapse, like we've seen in Cuba with this dramatic last few months. But also, I mean, the second part of what you were saying is also true. I mean, I'm not sure I would call it a done deal, but it's very much the case that Venezuela is now re-engaged with the United States. Its government has been recognized, and there's now a cascade of implications going forward. We saw one of them last week, which was the reestablishment of ties with the IMF and the World Bank, which may also have serious consequences.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The other thing, though, I mean, the way that re-engagement came about through the force of arms, through the death of somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 people during the kidnapping of the president and his wife. I mean, I would think politically that would still feature top and center, as it was only a few months ago at this meeting in defense of De La Democracia.
Yes, I mean, surprisingly, I mean, I'm not sure if it's surprising, but it has faded. But at the same time, it has also faded here. I mean, you very rarely see the Venezuelan government bring up the issue of Maduro's kidnapping, because it becomes kind of an immediate contradiction. You know, how can you, on the one hand, praise the restoring of diplomatic relations and quote-unquote cooperation with the U.S., even praising Trump and Rubio directly, and on the other, bring up the issue of Maduro being kidnapped by these very same people? So it's a very, even on the discourse level, it's become kind of impossible to manage. And I think, in a way, you cannot expect these progressive governments, which were already very uneasy with regard to Venezuela, you cannot expect them to outflank the Venezuelan government when it comes to Maduro. But I think it's also a mistake on their part, because it is by not doing and not saying anything, even accepting this precedent, you know, and once it's established, then somebody else might do it, and it just becomes a new norm, because we have seen that there are no consequences.
Yeah, well, it is in their self-interest, especially some, like in Spain's case, when they seem to be attracting the ire of the empire as it is. But what about for Venezuelans, like at the street level? Cuba was a huge project of Hugo Chavez. Venezuela was a great friend to Cuba for many, many years. Now they see what's going on in Cuba, the privations being visited upon them, and they are powerless to come to their aid. Is there not a sense of outrage? And the Cubans killed during the kidnapping operation as well. Has that sense of outrage faded now too, just 3 months from the night?
No, absolutely not. So here there's a phenomenon that's emerging. And of course, I mean, keep in mind that this is my reading of the situation from the people that I talk to. There's a bit of, I wouldn't call it a disconnect, but there's a slight difference between the discourse at the official level and what's happening downstream, you know, at the level of the grassroots. So Cuba has disappeared completely from the official discourse. There hasn't been, you know, even a statement. I mean, we used to joke that the Venezuelan foreign ministry would publish statements all the time, condemning everything and anything and everything all the time. And now they've gone completely silent. I mean, not even a statement condemning the oil blockade against Cuba. But at the level of grassroots movements, and even with some, let's say, government institutes mediating, there has been a solidarity campaign to, again, collect humanitarian aid. And just this Saturday, there was also a concert to raise funds, and this would be to contribute to the purchase of solar panels and so on. But it's been very, very, very slow, because it's just an initiative from the grassroots that has not had a real push from the Venezuelan state. And therefore, even if in this limited capacity of, you know, sending aid as opposed to before sending crude, it has been much slower than other countries like Mexico and Colombia also. So that's a situation that's emerging, and it also translates to other issues, like we're going to discuss the IMF, where at the grassroots there is a certain unease with what the official direction seems to be, but it still falls within the benefit of the doubt and, you know, there's, let's say, a general understanding of how delicate the situation remains.
Yeah, well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ricardo Vosch. Ricardo is a journalist, political analyst, and contributor with the communications collectives Tatui TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His latest there is Venezuelan Government Resumes IMF World Bank Ties, Appoints New Central Bank President. As I said, Ricardo, in the introduction, the acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, she called it a great achievement of Venezuelan diplomacy. Not a great maybe achievement for the people of Venezuela. Is that a hedging remark on her part, hinting that this is a matter of diplomacy only because Venezuela has an American pistol to its head right now?
I think this has become a very common feature of discourse, which I also find very concerning, you know, this idea that somehow there is a common sense that you can, that was lacking, you know, there's a common sense that was missing, and with diplomacy we're going to address our issues with the US, and that the problems with the economy are some kind of technical issue, and now you get the advice of the IMF and you're going to solve those problems. It's a very pragmatic and technocratic language, and also translated into policy. So with the IMF, there's perhaps a short-term issue and a long-term issue. The short-term issue is that you remember that during the COVID pandemic, the IMF issued some huge liquidity injection as the global economy was reeling. I mean, they got these special drawing rights, SDRs, which were meant for countries to use however they please. I mean, some used them to pay debt, others used them for infrastructure works and whatever. But Venezuela did not access what it should have, which were some $5 billion of special drawing rights, because around that time, you'll remember, there was this imaginary self-proclaimed, quote-unquote, interim government led by Juan Guaido, And the IMF just said, oh, we don't know who's in charge in Venezuela, so we cannot release those funds. And so now the carrot that is being hung, and this is what Rodriguez is focusing on, is that Venezuela is going to access this $5 billion. It's going to allow for some much needed, it must be said, short-term improvements to the electricity grid and water supply. Of course, I mean, we should also keep in mind that 5 billion did not extend indefinitely, but it's surely to be a short-term boost for a country that has struggled for so long to access this kind of resources. But my fear, and I think this is fairly well-grounded, unfortunately, is that this might be the opening to something in the long term, which is now that you are in touch with the IMF again, you have been recognized by the US government. The next step, or one of the next steps, is that creditors are going to get the US Treasury green light to renegotiate debt with the Venezuelan government. And this is a debt that is completely unpayable. I think I mentioned that in this report that you brought up. It might be as high as $170 billion. It's completely unpayable. If you do some kind of envelope calculations of some restructuring, paying 50 cents on the dollar and what have you over 15 years, even that would imply, I don't know, 25% of the budget for debt service. And that's completely unaffordable for an economy that has so many needs, and there's an urgency to increase people's incomes and so on. And so that might be, you know, the pressure of debt might be the perfect excuse for the US, through its multilateral lending institutions like the IMF, to impose a long-term compromise of the Venezuelan sovereignty, you know, some $60 billion loan from the IMF that will be paid over the next 40 years. And we know that these loans come with a price, you know, pun intended, which is, you know, structural adjustment, privatizations, layoffs, and so on. So my fear is that we are entering this phase where Venezuela does not have a lot of leverage, first and foremost because the US is currently controlling its oil revenues. And so it might not have a lot of leeway in terms of avoiding this kind of long-term scenario, because ultimately the US does not want Venezuela to prosper and be sovereign. It wants it to be settled in debt and dependent.
Well, and that's just the way that they do business, the World Bank and the IMF, and that's been long known. Chavez called it a weapon of U.S. imperialism. Just in 2025, as you cite, Maduro said, well, finally, we've broken the shackles of the World Bank and the IMF. And now to be thrown right back into it, we've seen what happened in Argentina and in other countries around the world. Anywhere the World Bank shows up, it's disaster. It's these structural adjustment programs, these things that were going on in the late last century that ruined Latin America and Africa and everywhere that they came to ground. I'm not sure why Delcy Rodriguez would think that this is a very important step forward for Venezuela right now to reintroduce, to allow this monster across the threshold again in Venezuela. I understand that her back is against the wall, but this is going to, it seems to me, is going to doom Venezuelans for generations.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the government has some other plan, and I'll be proven wrong. I certainly hope that it's the case. But it does seem like we are heading down this path of burying the country in debt and dependency, and shrouded by this technocratic logic of saying, oh, you know, we are just a member of the IMF and we have our duties and responsibilities, as if, you know, these multilateral institutions are neutral grounds where countries can go and have their points of view heard and even use them to their own advantage. I think that's perhaps the most fantastical of expectations when it comes to the IMF. But this very pragmatic and technocratic logic seems to be taking hold of government policy. And we've already seen it in major reform to the hydrocarbon law and also to mining. This idea that foreign investment is the holy grail and you have to do everything possible to attract foreign investments. But as you know, this is very vague, because you ask an investor, what do you want? And he's going to ask for the moon. So you just end up giving more and more concessions and this comes with the price, right? The price you pay is, you know, surrendering sovereignty in the long run. Of course, you understand that an economy under sanctions with very little room to maneuver, you have to look for ways to make concessions, but at least keeping in mind that you have to preserve long-term sovereignty. And one of the prevailing ideas under Maduro, you mentioned this quote that Maduro said, that, you know, we've broken free of the shackles of the IMF and the World Bank, and we are developing new relations with the new world that is emerging. And so at least the overriding logic was that, you know, Venezuela was going to adapt and survive this U.S. economic blockade. And then as the multipolar world emerges with all its limitations, it will, in the long run, reduce the damage that can be caused by U.S. sanctions and increase the room for maneuver that these countries in the global south can have. But now it's the complete opposite. There seems to be no interest at all in, or maybe it's not just what they want, it's also what the U.S. is imposing and forcing. There seems to be very little interest in extending ties with the likes of Russia and China and other countries in the global south, and rather foreign politics that are very much constrained by the U.S. sphere of influence.
Yeah, and that's, and again, the article is Venezuelan government resumes IMF World Bank ties, appoints new central bank president. That's at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And it seems that also included in the fast tracking the new legislation that you mentioned, one of them, the hydrocarbons law. But it's also that Venezuela, in its trade relations with the outside, with the greater world, is shackled as well. It's not allowed to trade, according to the Americans, with Iran, with China, with Russia, North Korea, anybody else, presumably, that they don't like, Cuba, certainly. Then there is the matter of the U.S. Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets and Control. And this, to me, was the most outrageous of all. Can you want to explain who the OFAC are and what their arrangement with Venezuela is?
Yeah, so basically the OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, is the U.S. Treasury body that's responsible for sanctions policy, so imposing restrictions on other countries. And when it comes to Venezuela, it imposed a large number of sanctions, and now it is issuing licenses. So this is something that gets confused in or perhaps deliberately confused in the corporate media, and that is worth clarifying, that a license is not the same as withdrawing a sanction. A license is a waiver. It's saying that this select entities, and they're usually U.S. entities or some select European and Canadian entities, can do something that was previously forbidden. And so that's what you were saying. Transactions with Cuba, China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are forbidden, but U.S. entities can deal with the Venezuelan oil sector and so on. And the most outrageous thing in these licenses, and it's usually the first clause, is something that says any payment owed to Venezuela must be made into an account run by the U.S. Treasury. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is something that is equal parts humiliating and equal parts outrageous, because, you know, under what divine right does the U.S. get to control Venezuela's revenues? But we've seen it so far, and there was even, they published an FAQ to clarify. So I apologize if this is going to be too technical, but for example, in the oil industry, Venezuela collects revenues on three stages. So the first one is royalties, which is not, royalties are not the tax, so it's just basically something you charge for being the owner. So that's kind of the first level. Then, you know, there's income tax. And then after the income tax, because the Venezuelan state oil company is usually a partner in these joint ventures, you collect dividends. So you get oil revenues on those three levels. And all those three specific payments, royalties, dividends, and taxes, are to be paid to this U.S. Treasury account. And then from their good hearts, U.S. Mm-hmm. officials will decide when and how much of it to return to Caracas and under which conditions. So, for example, it's not like it goes to the central bank for the Venezuelan government to decide how it wants to use its budget. Instead, it goes directly through private banks for them to sell foreign currency to private importers. So you have this additional layer of constraints on the Venezuelan economy.
Well, does the Venezuelan Central Bank or any other body connected with the Venezuelan government have representation inside U.S. Treasury to check the books? I mean, we see how corrupt the American administration is right now, the most corrupt probably in the history of that country. Is there anybody checking the math? I know that the assistant state secretary you mentioned in your article says that, oh, we've collected around $3 billion so far to remit back to Venezuela. I don't know what, I guess Michael Kozak, the representative, has a trouble with exact numbers, but give or take $3 billion or whatever the number is there any accounting offered to Venezuela to make sure, at least in this regard, they're getting their fair share back?
No, absolutely not. And I mean, it's very telling that someone goes to a congressional hearing without having a precise figure, because they're using this as their personal slush fund. So it wouldn't be surprising if they just take a cut from it. But there's also something perhaps a bit more sophisticated, which is that they are using these funds directly for imports from U.S. manufacturers, and whether those are ranked by how much they donated to the Trump campaign is my guess. But there's no accountability, and certainly the Venezuelan government has also avoided saying this because they don't want a constant reminder that they're not in charge of their oil revenues, which is their most important source of foreign currency. So it's a very uneasy situation, a very delicate situation where the Venezuelan government doesn't want to mention it and certainly does not want any confrontation. It's not denouncing the hijacking of its revenues as it perhaps should. And the U.S. Treasury and the Trump administration is just simply using it at its own discretion because they are above the law.
Well, and they reset the amount of the royalty amount to begin with and came in. And there's a lot of outside of the country, especially amongst in the left sort of spectrum, criticism of Delcy Rodriguez and her coterie as being sellouts and that. But you wrote another article, April 10th, Venezuelan National Assembly approves pro-business mining law. And that approval was in the National Assembly. It was unanimous, so everything can't be laid at the feet of the acting president right now. There's so much more here in the Cisneros group. I wanted to talk about it because there's a race to privatize everything, to denationalize all the work that seems to me that Hugo Chavez did while he was in power for a dozen and more years, being reversed. But we don't have time today, Carlos. I urge everyone go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com and check out Ricardo Vosch's work there. Thanks a lot, Ricardo, for coming on and talking to us a little bit more about it today. Hey,
no, my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to coming back and discussing whatever unfolds.
I look forward to it as well. Everyone else, stay tuned because Randy Caravaggio is coming on. We're going to talk about Cuba and his group sending aid and collecting aid to take to that island nation. Moscow, Tokyo, New York, guerrilla radio is everywhere. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago, Jakarta, Helsinki, Cape Town, Sao Paulo, Manchester, Bangalore, and somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name of.
But when it comes to the USA, no competition in the globe today. The cartel commanded by the dawn, terrorizing the world till it's gone. Leaving rubble and mass graves.